I'm just going to jump in, and we're going to be looking at early Christian views. I'm going to set the problem up by posing a philosophical problem the way that it was posed in antiquity. So the question is, can we be free while bound by a moral law? And our English word legal is derived from the Latin, and it comes from the word to bind. So obviously laws do bind us, right? They attempt to put limitations on our behavior by forbidding us to do certain things, and they attempt to make us do other things by commanding us to do them. Typically, we think of freedom as a lack of restraint. So prima facie, it seems impossible that a law could be something that frees us. So one way of dealing with this alleged problem is to say that, well, law is beneficial to us somehow, but it's not freeing, so to give up the freedom side of it. And of course, this is a recurrent opinion that we find in the history of philosophy, that law is the lesser of two evils. So people say it's true that law limits freedom, but this is a worthwhile trade-off in order to prevent personal injury or an even greater loss of personal freedom or just absolute chaos. So one version of this would be the type of social contract theory that we find, for example, in Book 2 of Plato's Republic, where the idea is that we're giving up some of our freedoms in order to prevent personal injury or loss of even more freedom of action than what we have right now. So why not go to the source and quote Plato directly? This is Glaucon speaking in Book 2. They say that to do injustice, which at this point in the Republic it means acting on one's own desires without limit, is naturally good. And to suffer injustice, in other words, to be on the receiving end of other people's unrestrained self-seeking, is naturally bad. But that the badness of suffering it so far exceeds the goodness of doing it, that those who have done and suffered injustice and tasted both, but who lack the power to do it and avoid suffering it, decide that it is profitable to come to an agreement with each other, neither to do injustice nor to suffer it. As a result, they begin to make laws and covenants, and what the law commands they call lawful and just. This, they say, is the origin and essence of justice. We can think of other examples from the history of philosophy. Perhaps Hobbes is a notable modern example. Another version of this type of approach would be what Plato calls tyranny, and what we would call control by a single ruler. And the idea here is that we give up freedom of action in order to prevent chaos, because chaos makes any desire satisfaction completely unpredictable and often unattainable. So the tyrant imposes order on chaos by enacting a set of policies that are ultimately arbitrary or based on his or her own interests alone. So Thrasymachus represents this position in Book 1 of the Republic, and then we have the tyrant figure in Plato's Republic later on in Books 8 and 9. And the idea is that excessive action in one direction, in other words, extreme freedom of action by everyone, usually sets up a reaction in the opposite direction, which would be some type of totalitarian or arbitrary imposition of a set of policies or rules to bring some kind of organization to society. Machiavelli is often considered to be having this kind of position as well. He extols the prince, and the prince has virtù, but virtù is the opposite of what classical virtues are. Virtù is just the ability to control people, to maintain one's own power, and there is a type of order in society with the prince, but it doesn't have any grounding in anything other than the prince's desires. Okay, so for people who don't want that type of approach to the problem, we have a counterposition, which says that rationality is law, and that rationality is autonomous and hence free. Okay, so we're free because of law, because law is rational autonomy. So the idea here is that true slavery is being at the mercy of one's own desires for the esteem of others, or the desire for social status, or the desire for physical satisfactions and pleasures. And this, of course, is a view that we find commonly in ancient philosophy. Kant also holds this view. And according to this type of view, the tyrant that we saw in the previous slide is actually a slave, because he's a slave to his own whims, his own desires. Being free is being guided by an objective standard of rational behavior. This is also often called the freedom of liberty as opposed to the freedom of license. So freedom is being able to do what makes sense even when there's a strong desire pulling you in a different direction. And then specifically Kantian additions to this set of points, we have the idea that because each person has rationality, each person is autonomous, meaning the source of one's own law. And human dignity resides in the fact that we are not subject to another's law, which would be heteronomy, but to our own. We're self-legislators, according to Kant. Desire satisfaction plays no role in deciding what is lawful. Reason and desire are two different things. The desire for something is a kind of heteronomy, since a goal external to the self makes the self subject to that goal. Okay, so I want to propose today the natural law concept as an alternative third way between these two horns of the dilemma. The origins of the natural law theory are in the ancient Stoics, and the natural law theory is also used by early Christian authors, so I'm going to focus particularly on Origen, Ambrose, and Augustine, who are the ones that make the most explicit use of it. We find it, of course, in medieval authors, Albert the Great and his student Thomas Aquinas, and then also in some modern authors. So Hooker, who is an Anglican divine, basically follows Aquinas, and then Locke follows Hooker up to a point and then diverges from Hooker. And of course, in contemporary theory, we have what we call the new natural lawyer. So Robert George at Princeton is a famous example, and then John Finnis. So the proponents of ethical and political theories of natural law disagree about the precise features of their models, but they share the belief that a natural law account is characterized by most, if not all, of the following attributes. First, the criterion to be used in ethics and politics is reasonableness. And from this, several things follow. First of all, the standards of morality and public order are not mere convention or precedent, and this allows for the possibility of ongoing critique and revision of personal behavior, societal customs, and particular civil laws. Second, moral and political norms are not arbitrary or subjective. Morality is not reducible to the mere desires or unsupported opinions of individuals, nor can public justice be identified with the will of whoever happens to retain power. And lastly, the standard is not epistemically mysterious or elitist. It's accessible to anyone who has reason and is capable of rational investigation. And everyone who is reasonable is bound by the same law, right? Because it's a law of reason. And natural law theorists say this is how we can explain the fact that we find moral maxims like the silver rule and the golden rule in many different cultures throughout the world, whether they're religious traditions or not. I don't know if people are familiar with the silver rule. Does anyone want to suggest what it is? Yeah.
Not to do to someone else what would be undesirable to you.
Right. Don't do to yourself what you would hate to have done to you by another is the way it's put in the book of Tobit in the Hebrew Bible. But the way he formulated it is synonymous, and we find this in many different cultural traditions. Golden rule, of course, is the positive formulation, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. Okay. Second point about natural law, ethical standards and the foundations of jurisprudence are not heteronomous, but they're internal to the ones who are ruled by them. They are therefore a source of authenticity and in some sense autonomy for those who obey moral norms and civil laws. Third, the same metric that measures the excellence of human behaviors and civil laws applies in analogous ways throughout the universe. So despite the fact that this law is internal, obedience to the law puts individuals into a kind of harmony with the whole human race and the larger ecosystem. Fourthly, conformity to the natural law is in no case harmful or even neutral with regard to the subject's own happiness, but is positively beneficial. For the law prescribes actions that tend to the well-being of the subject, but which she would not be motivated to do without this law. Since happiness is the fulfillment of all desires, fulfillment of the law satisfies human desires. So to sum up what we've just seen, we could say natural law is supposed to be freeing, right? It's supposed to be freeing in various ways. It delegitimizes despotic, arbitrary, willful, or merely conventional rule. Its contents are freely available to anyone who can think. It's not a set of restrictions imposed by an outside power, since the law is internal to oneself. Following it frees one from isolation by integrating one into a cosmic harmony. And following it frees one from unhappiness or dissatisfaction. So it promises quite a lot, this law. So we're going to go to the history of philosophy now and look at accounts in early Christian authors. Elizabeth Anscombe, who is not an early Christian, who's a 20th century philosopher, famously attributed a law conception of ethics to Christianity through the Torah. But she also mentioned the Stoics in her this famous article in Modern Moral Philosophy. And it is true that the exegetical tradition in the Bible was supplemented with Stoic accounts of natural law. This is just, the third point there is just an example. It's not specifically about natural law, but it's just an example of the way that ethics was not developed fully in the Christian tradition until Greek philosophy was given a very prominent place within it. So we have the case, for example, of God commanding Abraham to kill Isaac in Genesis chapter 22. And if you look at the rabbis, what the rabbis say about it, and what other Christian authors who are going off of the Jewish tradition say about it, you don't find anything that says clearly that God would never command the killing of an innocent person and mean it. You really don't find that until Augustine, and he says it very clearly. And he has to interpret the Bible in a particular way in order to maintain that position. And the reason he maintains it is because of his philosophical training, the Greco-Roman philosophical ideas, the idea of intrinsically evil act and that can never be abridged even by God, right? So it's interesting. Okay, so let's look at Origen. The question comes up for Christians because of the text of Romans, the second chapter of Romans. When the Gentiles who have not the law do by nature the works of a law, those who have not the law are a law unto themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their consciences bearing witness therewith. So Origen identifies this law as Stoic common conceptions that are sown into the soul or written in the governing part of human beings, and he also calls this the natural law. So here's a direct quote. I think it's worth reading in its entirety. And besides all this, the word sown into the soul, evinced by the moral notions common to mankind, and in scriptural language written in the heart, enjoining what we have to do, forbidding what we must not do, is called law. This is proved by the following words of the apostle, etc. For the law written in men's hearts and in Gentiles who by nature do the things of the law is no other than the law of common morality, by nature written in our governing part, and day by day becoming clearer with the perfecting of reason. And then he adds that the content of the natural law is the so-called silver rule, and some of the Ten Commandments at least. So stealing and adultery are typically the Ten Commandments that the early Christians single out following Origen. Okay, so I want to focus on the technical Stoic terms and concepts used by Origen. A lot of people think that natural law is a Christian conception, right? That it's something that it came about in the history of the West because of this text of Romans. But actually, if you look at what's happening, the text of Romans, it's not exactly clear what it means in itself. And so the authors use Stoicism to try to interpret it. So first of all, sown into the soul. This is actually a technical Stoic term, the seeds of the virtues. And it's an epistemological position that the Stoics have, which means that we automatically recognize bad actions as bad and good actions as good and attractive without explicit teaching about good and bad. So you don't need to be told by your parents that certain actions are bad or yucky or ugly and other actions are good and beautiful and admirable. You just notice this on your own. Just as in the same analogous way that you sense things and are aware that they're there, you are aware when someone does an action that it's morally beautiful or it's morally ugly, it's good or it's bad. This is the claim. The second thing is he says there are moral notions common to all human beings. So again, it's technical terminology when he says common notions. And this goes all the way back to Chrysippus. Sometimes they're called which are like preliminary concepts. Okay. And the idea is that we just automatically attain these concepts by going through the world and experiencing the world. We see people doing actions and we form these concepts. Written in our governing part. So the governing part is the hegemonicon, which is the mind, according to the Stoics. It names a particular power in the human soul. And it's reason. It's reasonable. The reasoning power. And then this is actually a Stoic definition of law. When he says law enjoins what we have to do and forbids what we must not do, and this is called law, this is actually Chrysippus' definition of law, which is cited in many ancient sources. Philo of Alexandria, first century Jew, is one example. He says this cosmos is the great city and it has a single polity and a single law. This law is the reason of nature, commanding what should be done and forbidding what should not be done. This is basically a paraphrase of Chrysippus. Okay, so to sum up, for Origen, we have natural law is something in the reason of rational creatures. The biblical term heart he glosses as reason or mind. Okay, this is something important. I think many people today are not aware of what the word heart has meant in the history of the West. People think of it as a biblical term that has to do with emotion or something, and it's never the way it was really understood in the Christian intellectual tradition of the West. It's a set of common conceptions about morality, also called the seeds. The conceptions have a commanding and prohibitive function in the mind of the person. So apparently we're supposed to understand that the law that's internal to us, we experience it as a mental imperative, something telling us do this and don't do that. And this would be correct according to Stoic thinking, because the Stoics posited that there's a type of mental language that all humans have, that our reason has a syntactical structure in the way that it operates, and that various moods of the verb correspond to sayables, they call them lecta, in various moods, and they talk about mental imperatives. He also has told us that by obeying these imperatives, we're a law unto ourselves, so we're seeing an idea of autonomy in some sense. He says the common conceptions are not perfected at birth, but they come perfected over time with the exercise of reason. This is also very Stoic, because the idea of the seeds is that the seeds have to grow, right? So you don't automatically have scientific knowledge of ethics just by walking through the world. You have vague notions of good and bad, right and wrong. Okay, so the idea is the more we develop, the more autonomous we are, right? Because we become more perfect in our reason. And then just a caveat, which is probably obvious to most people here, but for Origen and the Stoics, autonomy does not mean simply self-legislating, as in Kant, because human reason is a participation in the same reason that God has, but in a far inferior degree in way. So if we submit to the law, we're submitting to our own reason. We also are submitting to God. That doesn't mean we have to know that the law comes from God, but de facto, that's what's happening, because reason is the same. Okay. Let's look at Ambrose. We're moving now to the Latin Western side of things. So he knows Origen because he was perfectly fluent in Greek as well as Latin. And he recapitulates some of the elements found in Origen. It's not clear if he gets them from Origen or from some other source that agreed with Origen, but he says there's a law of nature written on the human heart. Its contents include at least some of the Ten Commandments. He does make a brief allusion to naturally produced beliefs about good and evil. And then he adds something that's not extant in Origen. The natural law can also refer, for Ambrose, to non-rational animals' inborn sense of what is appropriate for them to do. So he gives examples that animals naturally are oriented to eat the right amount for health and not more. So they're not naturally gluttonous. They're naturally what we would call moderate. They eat the right amount. They eat for health. And they swim to the right place for mating. So their actions are guided by what's healthy for them is the underlying idea. And he calls this natural law as well. Okay, so this new thing that we see in Origen, it's not really new, but it wasn't in Origen. Sorry, in Ambrose. This thing that we see in Ambrose that was not in Origen is also from the Stoics originally. The Stoics said that all animals have an inborn aptitude for self-care, which they call oikeiosis. In other words, that animals recognize the things that are their own, and they take care of themselves with things that belong to them, by seeking out things that belong to them. That's what the Greek is saying. And that the specifically human version of this is called natural law. So Ambrose plays fast and loose a little bit with the terminology, and he calls what animals have natural law, which is not something that the Stoics do, because for the Stoics, law is a mental imperative, or it's an imperative in spoken language, and animals don't have that for the Stoics, because they don't have reason. But this idea that there's some type of continuity between humans and animals, and that this is indicated by the term natural law, that is from the Stoics. So we see that some of the philosophical terminology from the Stoics have dropped out of the picture with Ambrose. They were there in Origen, but he does not use these technical terms like common conceptions, these are the virtues, the governing part, the hegemonicon. But he has retained this basic idea, right, that what the seeds were supposed to convey, which was that we have an inborn tendency to produce beliefs about good and evil. Okay, if we want to talk about freedom, the final point there addresses that. Ambrose implies that the natural law is something that gives freedom in the normative sense of acting appropriately for one's species. So humans who act contrary to natural law are less free, he says, than animals who automatically follow it because they lack free choice. So the idea is you're more free if you're rational, if you're behaving rationally. And animals actually behave in a way that makes sense because they don't overeat. They just eat enough for health. And so he says, well, actually, animals sometimes act more rationally. They're not rational, but they act rationally. And therefore, they're more free in the sense of doing what's reasonable. Kind of interesting. Okay, now we're going to move to Augustine. And then I'm going to just give you an idea of where we're going. I'm going to say something about Aquinas and 20th century debates about this stuff. So Augustine says more about natural law than Origen and Ambrose. But he shares elements with both of them. So again, we see there is a natural law in the heart. The content is the same as at least some of the Ten Commandments and the Silver Rule. Now, he also says something that we haven't seen Origen Ambrose saying, which is that the natural law also includes the impulse that its contents be respected in one's own case by others. So he starts talking about humans don't want certain behaviors to be done to them. So we don't want to be stolen from. We don't want to have our wife cheat on us. And in this wanting, we are evincing the natural law, which says that stealing and adultery are wrong. Okay, so this is kind of interesting because up till now we've seen that it's something of reason, it's cognitive, and now he's bringing in what we call a desiderative or a cognitive component. And like Ambrose, he talks about a continuity with other animals. So he says there are natural impulses in both humans and other animals, and these are the impulse, for example, to stay alive, to have offspring for the preservation of the human race, to feed one's offspring, to move oneself locally, to seek pleasure and avoid pain. And in the case of humans particularly, there's an impulse to know the truth about things human and divine, and not to be morally transgressed by others, as I already mentioned. And then finally, Augustine is unlike Ambrose in that he insists that natural law is only in humans who have the exercise of free choice. So he talks about children not yet having free choice, but that once children pass the age at which they do, then we can speak of them as having natural law or operating according to natural law. Okay, so I think I've covered those points except the last one, tying it back to freedom. The natural law gives freedom in the sense of rational autonomy. It gives freedom in the sense of acting on one's natural desires or impulses, doing what you want, essentially. And then normative freedom, acting the way one ought to act, acting appropriately for one's species. So Augustine obviously has the most complex view if we're talking about the relationship between freedom and law, because he incorporates multiple senses of freedom. But the question then is how he can combine all of these elements that are in his account that gave us this complex, rich view. He says that the natural law gives freedom in the sense of rational autonomy and in the sense of acting on one's natural desires or impulses, and that some of these desires or impulses are ones we share with non-rational animals. So then we have the question, how is acting according to desires or impulses that we share with non-rational animals compatible with acting according to a law of reason? Doesn't seem to make sense. Now, if we go back to the Stoics, we can actually see what the answer is supposed to be to this question. And the way that we know that Augustine, too, is using the Stoics is that he uses a technical term. So when he's saying natural impulses, this is Ciceronian terminology for what the ancient Stoics called horme. And they ascribe inborn homme to both humans and animals. Seneca as well uses this terminology. Seneca usually uses the term impetus instead of appetitus, but they're both translations of homme. So impulse is one part of a twofold motivational structure that the Stoics ascribe to animals, and these the two parts together are called self-care, or oikeiosis, this term that we saw earlier. So the argument of the Stoics is that from birth, every animal, including the human animal, because humans are rational social animals, seek the things which support their life and health while being alienated from those that threaten well-being. And this behavior pattern is evidence of an innate orientation towards self-care. So the universal disposition is natural in the sense that it is innate. It's untaught, it's not learned by imitation of other animals. So the classic example that they give is the mammalian rooting and sucking reflex, right? If you've ever seen a human infant, they automatically start rooting, like looking for something to suck. And this is not just in humans, but mammals generally. And the point is, it's untaught. They do it from the time they're born. So it's different from Aristotle's position on animals, if you think about it, because Aristotle, he cataloged instances of animals fleeing from predators or being smart enough to take some action to attain food or something. But the Stoics used these examples, they gave more examples of their own, and they emphasized that these behaviors are from birth, unlearned, and that therefore we have to posit this inborn disposition. Okay, now, we want to talk more about the two components that I just mentioned. So again, the argument for two components is evidential. It's supposed to be evidential and empirical, just like the argument for the existence of oikeiosis. The argument that oikeiosis has two parts is also supposed to be based on an inference from animal behavior. So they say the ways that animals act for the sake of survival shows that oikeiosis has two parts. Animals instinctively use their most suitable limbs to ward off the predators that are particular to their species. Bulls stick out their horns and not their tails in self-defense when confronted by a natural enemy. They do this the first time they encounter a natural enemy before having had experience of the enemy. So this shows a cognitive disposition that itself has two parts. First of all, they must have a basic overall awareness of their own constitution, which the Stoics or Cicero called sensus sui, a sense of oneself overall. We would talk about homeostasis, that the organism is aware of whether it's in homeostasis or not, for example. And they have a basic awareness of the functionalities of their parts, so they know what their limbs are for. They don't misuse their limbs. And then second, they have an unlearned awareness of what kinds of things threaten the kind of animal that they are, and also the kinds of things that are useful for them. So they seek out the things that are their food. They don't just randomly try to eat everything. Okay, then secondly, the impulsive disposition. This is the appetitus or the impetus that we saw in Augustine. There's a natural impulse, which is rendering hexis hormitike in the Greek Stoics, toward actions by which they may keep themselves intact and well. So Seneca says, for example, there are natural impulses to what is useful and natural rejections of the opposite. So for the Stoics, the cognitive component is primary. The impulses follow from impressions, and impressions are cognitive impressions, right? So it's a perception of something in the world. So you have to have the sensory structure underlying the impulses for the impulses to exist. And you see there in the quote from Cicero, from De Finibus, right? He's telling us appetitus is his technical term for horme. So just a note, in some of the texts, you see the Stoics saying animals love themselves. They have self-love. But what they mean by love is not an affective feeling. They're not talking about affection for oneself exactly. Sometimes you see it translated that way. But the idea is it's a dispositional impulse to act, right? So it's an orientation towards doing certain things with regard to certain types of objects. And of course, it's not the same as a subjective preference in the individual animal, because self-care consists in those things that are objectively determined by the health requirements of the given species. at its individual stage of development. So the view is sophisticated in the sense that they recognize that at various stages of development, what is appropriate for the animal changes. So Seneca gives the example of when a baby is just learning to stand up, it will keep falling down, but it will keep trying to stand on its own. So it's transitioning from one stage to the other. So it's doing that because it's becoming appropriate for the animal at that stage of its development for that species to stand, right? So there are shifts within the species, but of course the goal is to get to adulthood, and once you're at adulthood, there's no shift and the object's appropriate. All right, so what does all this have to do with morality, we want to ask? How is acting according to desires or impulses that we share with non-rational animals compatible with acting according to a law of reason? That was our question. Again, the Stoics are going to help us, right? So what they want to say about the inborn cognitive disposition is that in animals it's non-rational, but in humans it's rational, conceptual. And we see Cicero saying this. He says, for the power and nature of minds is twofold. One part consists in apetitus, which is hormaean grief, and which impels man this way and that. And the other consists in reason, which teaches and explains what is to be done and what is to be avoided. We see in the last phrase, right, it's the Stoic definition of law. What is to be done and what is to be avoided. So the Stoics connect human natural law ethics with animal motivation through the human ability to form a concept of healthfulness. So for humans, oikeosis includes the ability to know, for example, that we eat for the sake of health. Animals eat for the sake of health, but they don't know that we eat for the sake of health. And this is a more important part, the second sentence. It also includes the ability to correctly apply health in variable circumstances. And correct application of this concept is itself a form of health seeking for humans. I'm going to talk about this on the next slide. I'll explain in more detail, but this is actually the crux of the matter for connecting morality with this account of human and animal action. So just to illustrate what I'm talking about, self-care in humans includes a predisposition toward acting in the rationally optimal way, prudent way, and through prudence toward acting well in more specific domains, justice and social interactions, moderation, physical satisfactions, fortitude, and acting well even in difficult circumstances. This specific predisposition is the seeds of the virtues. The objects of this predisposition intersect with the objects of animal self-care in the case of many human actions. So humans have a predisposition of reason toward acting prudently, doing the things that are appropriate for them as animals and as social animals. So human oikeosis orients us towards eating food because we see that it will sustain us, but it also orients us towards eating moderately, prudently, and justly, eating no more and no less than what health requires, eating at times that will provide the necessary energy to perform other tasks, eating a balanced diet, which includes eating some things we don't like, and eating in a decorous way. Okay, so how is this healthful, right? Because the claim is that animals seek what's healthful, humans seek what's healthful, and know that it's healthful, and that this can explain human morality. This can explain how we naturally know right from wrong. How is the correct application of the concept of health in various circumstances itself a form of health seeking for humans? And the answer is that the mind is naturally for the cognition of reality. So actions that are in conflict with virtues are committed because the mind has assented to false propositions about what behavior is most appropriate. And the claim is this is damaging for the mind. And this is why the Stoics say that vicious people are mentally unwell. You know, if you're reading the Tusculan Disputations, you'll see Cicero says, well, people who are morally bad are crazy. And you think, what is he talking about? But the claim is that it's falsehood, right? So falsehood is bad for us. It's like eating unhealthy food or trying to eat something that's not food for you, for your species, if you make false judgments about what type of behavior is appropriate. So is there a derivation of an ought from an is, right? This is a question that people like the new natural lawyers are interested in asking. They're concerned about that. And the claim is it's a fallacy of non sequitur, right? This is the view of Hume. But it's the same thing as saying you should eat because you need food for health. Once we establish that you need food for health, it follows that you should eat. And it's just the same claim, but about the mind. You need truth for health, therefore you should judge correctly about action. In other words, therefore you should be prudent, therefore you should be just, therefore you should be courageous. All right, so I'm just going to focus briefly in the final 2 minutes on the afterlife of this account. And Aquinas, of course, is the most famous proponent of natural law theory, we could say. And he says that natural law is in humans as a natural conception and a natural inclination. So we see that twofold, cognitive-cognitive orientation. But strictly speaking, natural law applies to the cognitive component, the natural conception. He reproduces this Stoic idea, right, that it's analogous to what animals do from birth. They have an estimation of what's helpful and harmful. His term, natural inclination, actually means a Stoic natural impulse towards action for the sake of self-care. And to prove this, I'd have to go through texts and do the lexical, show you the lexical correspondences, but I think it's very clear if you know what to look for. He also appropriates the Stoic idea of seeds of the virtues. He's getting this stuff mainly from Cicero and partly from Augustine, but in Augustine it's very scattered. So I think my study of Aquinas is that he saw people like Albert the Great and Augustine alluding to natural law, and then he decided to go to Cicero to try to find the roots of the theory. Because when I read him and compare and contrast him with what Albert the Great says, what Augustine says, what Origen says, I find more similarities with Cicero himself than with these intermediate authors. So that's in the final point. There is some engagement with Albert the Great, and there is some engagement with Avicenna, for example, because Avicenna talks about natural estimation in animals. But if you look actually at what's happening, you can see he's using Ulpian, and Ulpian is a Roman jurist who defines natural law in a way that's derived from Stoicism, and then he's also using Cicero, I would argue. So the texts of Cicero are De Natura Neorum 2 and De Finibus 5. De Legibus 1 is another one that he relies on, and parts of De Officiis. Okay, so how can this help us with contemporary philosophical and jurisprudential debates about the proper interpretation of Aquinas? First of all, if we know that Aquinas is coming out of this tradition, we know that he's saying the natural desires or impulses that we share with non-rational animals do not themselves show us what the appropriate goods are for our pursuit. So reason doesn't use the impulses as data upon which it reflects to then grasp the goodness of the helpful objects. This is something you find sometimes in some of the new natural lawyers. It's the idea that we have these drives, these animal drives or these desires, and then reason is going to reflect on the desires, and the desires will then tell us what we should pursue, what's reasonable to pursue. This is not actually what Aquinas thinks. Because the impulses that he thinks are relevant to natural law are strictly byproducts of the rational recognition of what serves health. Because I didn't mention this in the slide, but like Augustine, he emphasizes that natural law is only something that is operative and relevant in people who are over the age of reason, which is around 7 for the Stoics and also for the medievals. So the raw animal desires that humans experience when they're children or babies are not indicative of what to do. The only thing that's indicative of what to do is when reason recognizes something as healthful. It falls under the concept of healthful. Okay. We've seen number 2 already. And Aquinas' natural law is freeing, therefore, in all the ways asserted by Augustine. It's rationally autonomous. It's in accord with our deepest desires. It frees us from moral vice, and therefore it frees us from unhappiness. Okay, the final point I wanted to make was 20th century debates in moral theology, since this is a conference on Christianity and freedom. So Pinkiers and Cotier, two famous Dominican theologians, were ghostwriters for a document called The Splendor of Truth, which was issued in 1993 under the pontificate of John Paul II. And in it, they reiterated the classical Thomistic account of natural law against neo-Kantian ethical theories that claim to be superior to Aquinas' natural law account. These theories charge that traditional natural law sorry, these theories charged the traditional natural law account with physicalism or naturalism, meaning that Aquinas' theory of natural law allegedly presents as moral laws what are in themselves mere biological laws. They presented instead an account of human reason as the source of meaning for the physical actions carried out by human rational agents, and thus argued for autonomy in a Kantian sense. We're self-legislators, is the idea. So the document insists that Aquinas' theory of natural law is not physicalist or naturalist, and that human reason is not autonomous in the sense of being the final arbiter of meaning and moral truth, but is autonomous in the sense of a participated theonomy. So theonomy meaning the law is from God, or God is the law, and we participate in that by natural law, which is our reason. Of course, it goes really back to the Stoics, because that's also how they conceive of natural law in humans. It's a participation in reason, and God is mind or reason for the Stoics. That's certainly something that everyone in that tradition thinks, Origen, Ambrose, Augustine, Aquinas. The document gives an accurate description of Aquinas' view and how it differs from the contemporary alternative views, but it does not explain how Aquinas' view does not commit the fallacy of non sequitur, trying to derive an ought from it is, nor does it explain the connection between the natural impulses and reason. So that's why I think this is important, and that's why I've talked about those issues here. Just to give due credit to Pinkers, I should note that he did assert briefly in a book that he wrote prior to The Splendor of Truth that Cicero is important. But what he says is that Aquinas is recapitulating Cicero De Officiis, part of 1.4, and that he's not naming Cicero, but he's basically basing the article on the first part of the second part of the Summa on this passage from Cicero. But a number of people have noted that, like, when you try to compare these passages, there are a lot of dissimilarities. And this passage, I think he's right that Cicero is important, but this passage is not the one. And in my work, I'm seeing much more resonance with De Finibus 5 and De Legibus 1, De Natura Deorum 2. So Pinker's on the right track, but I think in the details he got it wrong. So that's all I have to say. I hope we can have questions. Thank you for paying attention.
So I don't claim to be a natural law expert.
Sure.
You know, as you're going through the Stoic contributions to this tradition, something that really raised the question in my mind was, what then is the distinctive contribution of Christianity to this development?
Right.
Because it would seem, and you may correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that there's this tension almost between the ancients and the Christian way of looking at the world in terms of the use of reasonableness and the measure of these truths. The ancients may say that possibly these truths are universal in some Stoic sense, but they're only accessible to a very well-educated, you know, elite. Whereas, of course, the Christians may then want to say that, well, that may be true. There's something about reason itself that can go corrupt. They can rebel against God, they can rebel against the natural order in some sense, and then make itself up and become its own arbiter of truth, like a Kantian kind of like self-assertion. And I was wondering then, what sense are these traditions in tension when the Christians begin to adopt the Stoic reasonableness into their realm of faith or whatever? Is there something quite contradictory in the sense that, on the one hand, Christians may assert that reason can be corrupted, and the ancients may want to say that reason is not corruptible, but can only be accessed by very few, or versus the universalism of the Christian position, versus elitism. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering where you think, what the distinctive contribution of Christianity is to that.
Right. I think they're not substantially different. The distinctive contribution is in the remedy that's applied to the difficulty. So, you know, Seneca is, the Stoics generally are very negative about people's ability to arrive at actually scientific understanding of ethics and the virtues, most people. So this is in Plato as well, right? But the way the Stoics put it is, the wise person is as rare as the phoenix, which is a mythical creature. So it doesn't really basically, for all practical purposes, doesn't exist. But of course, they want to say that there's evidence of natural law in the fact that everyone has the basic concept of right and wrong, or just and unjust. They just tend to apply it incorrectly, most people. So then the etiology that's given for that by the Stoics is it's bad conditioning from society, from your parents. So you, when you're born, you have the right tendencies, but your parents are corrupt. So they teach you the wrong thing. They let you watch bad TV. So it's all down to society, right? And of course, this is a Platonic type of answer as well. That if we, and Aristotle, that if we can just habituate people well enough, then we, in theory, we would be able to correct this problem. But we just can't get it off the ground because every generation is already corrupted by the previous one. So we would have to be starting fresh. This is why Plato says in the Republic, right? Everyone over the age of 10 is a lost cause. If we want to start this city, we're going to have to take out all the children and start from scratch with them. So, on the other hand, you do see, especially in Plato, a sensitivity to the fact that we always have these other parts of the soul. So no matter how well habituated we are, we can fall from a situation of excellent education. And this is what books 8 and 9 of the Republic are about. It's the devolution of people through these various stages. Or Oscar Wilde's picture of Dorian Gray, right? It's a description of the same thing. So, anyways, this is long-winded, but I think the answer is that the part of the reason why the early Christians like the ancients and think that it's so compatible with Christianity is that Christianity just gives you a reason or a cause for why we have these parts inside of us that can pull us away even under situations of excellent habituation. And then Christianity gives you grace, which is supposed to be medicinal in a superior way to habituation because it acts interiorly on your motivations and your mind. So someone like Augustine, we call him like the doctor of grace, the person who has the most sophisticated theory of grace of the early Christians, he describes it as something that acts on the mind. And he describes it actually in Stoic terms. He says, God gives you hormetic impressions of virtuous actions. So God acts on your mind to cause you to see that virtuous actions are actually good for you, that they serve your health. Because oikeiosis is disrupted as a result of damage that you suffered to your psyche because of original sin. And grace is going to fix that problem. Yes, sir.
So I have a question about the connection that you're talking, especially with Ambrose, and the idea of the seed of virtues as an example. The Stoics themselves built upon Aristotle and Plato, mm-hmm. quite very consciously so. And you're finding ideas that you say that Ambrose had about the seed of virtue without the terminology of the Stoics, but that shouldn't be surprising because Aristotle's ethics is built on that same presupposition. Otherwise, phronesis won't work, and without that, the whole of virtue disappears. And Plato seems to have something different in his recollection. So it is just a recollection. Like the Stoics seem to be building on those two ideas and combining them. So it will make sense that Ambrose will come up with a similar idea without this Stoic terminology because he's looking at the same sources as the Stoics. So how can your argument, and Cicero himself, many times considering himself more of an academic,
He was just a doxographer when it came to Stoicism, presenting it, but he's not a Stoic. Yeah,
like he alternated or he combined himself. But, so I could just read this and be like, no, Ambrose and Augustine, they're just based on Plato and Aristotle, and it so happens that the Stoics are also based on Plato and Aristotle, hence all the parallels.
Well, I think it depends what you mean by based on. I mean, to a certain extent, the Stoics are based on Plato, but they're certainly, this is unique to them. This is an addition. This is a development in the history of philosophical theories of animal psychology and human psychology. And something like the seeds of the virtues is not, that's not Aristotle. Because, and Aquinas actually, in the De Veritate, he distinguishes what type of potency is synderesis, or the seeds of the virtues. He says it's an active potency. It's not a passive potency. So when you look at Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics, he compares the situation of people who haven't been habituated to a blind person, someone without the power of sight. And that's a passive potency, because that means you have to be given the ability to see, and then and then it can be activated through light and actually sensory objects. But Aquinas' position, actually, if you understand what Seeds of the Virtues means, and he glosses it as active potency correctly, I think, explaining what that means in Cicero, it's that you're not blind when you're born. You have sight, but you need objects and light in order to see actual things. But that's different from a mere aptitude in the sense of a passive potency, which is what Aristotle talks about in Nicomachean Ethics. Yes, sir.
Well, one question about what distinguishes the Christian view from the Greek and Roman would be how well it addresses the issue of when things don't go well.
Okay.
And to me, the name that Christians have for when things don't go well is sin.
Uh-huh.
And that the logic you've laid out comes down to variants of to know the good is to do the good. Whether it's innate, or whether it's learned, or whether it's a social contract. And I'm thinking particularly of a passage in the Confessions of Augustine, when he talks about there's a law, and then the law of his limbs tells him to do something else.
Mm-hmm. Romans 7.
And how do you manage the internal conflicts?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, your answer earlier alluded to that when you talked about grace.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the notion of grace is a supernatural disposition. And that our access to grace from a Christian perspective is only allowed by the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus the Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And that to know the good is not to do the good unless and until grace is available. And that's a extrinsic, unilateral act on God's part that gives us access to something we wouldn't have as natural creatures.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think maybe you're alluding to what I was saying. Grace for Augustine is something that acts on the mind. It's something mental. And you're saying, well, how is that not a way of saying knowing the good is doing the good, which doesn't seem to be what grace is all about, right? But the thing is that the Stoics distinguish, and Augustine therefore also distinguishes, between different ways of being aware or knowing something. So they have what we would call like purely epistemic impressions, cognitive impressions. So I could say like, this is a bottle of water. That's one way of being aware of it cognitively. But it's another thing to say, this is an attractive, water is attractive and yummy and I need water. So what grace does is, I mean, people who know the good but don't do it are people who know that. It's like Augustine talking in the Confessions about Ambrose. He says, I admire him, and I saw that the way he was living was nice and good for him, but I thought I would be miserable doing that. So a hormetic impression is when you actually see it as something appetible or something worth acting to get. And that's what Augustine thinks grace does for you, is that suddenly these actions, this is what he describes in Book 8 of the Confessions, this way of life that he saw Ambrose living that he was not attracted to, suddenly he's attracted to it. And he thinks there's no way to account for that by merely natural causes, because naturally we're the product of habituation. And so he didn't have the habits to see it that way, but all of a sudden he saw it that way. So this is why he thinks there had to be grace, and it was supernatural. But supernaturally, what's given is a certain type of perception, cognitive perception. It's not just like this desire disconnected or not caused by a cognitive perception. Yes, in the back.
You mentioned that the Stoics, the natural law is a mental imperative.
Yes.
And therefore not applicable to animals.
Right.
And I guess my question, and it seems as though the Christian philosophers who come later borrow on that or build on that. Are there branches in philosophy that have gone down a different path, which have said that in fact perhaps animals do have some form of mental imperative, but at just a much lower level? I'm just curious whether that's a path that people have taken to somehow bring the natural law into the kind of animal sphere as well as the human sphere.
Right. No. I mean, the idea is that the animals have a sensory awareness of what's appropriate, and then they automatically have the urge to go after it. So insofar as they have an urge, there is an impelling that they are undergoing, but they are not saying to themselves, I must get that thing. Yes?
As a pet owner from my earliest years on and off, it's clear to me that Ambrose never had a pet, because his suggestion that animals eat only until they are healthy is pathetic. Every pet owner, among pet owners, fights day and night to keep their pet from overeating. Secondly, you know, in biblical passage, we constantly hear of the succulents foods that are an image of eternal bliss and hunting out the beard as true fulfillment. And so I wonder if all this is just a head game and actual harmony in society comes from correct worship and the enlightenment as to how we behave toward others through correct worship. And if Aquinas's systematizing of theology didn't in fact precipitate the Reformation that gave us this idea that we could turn human existence into a head game instead of a union with an eternal God that is intimately involved in each of our lives individually and as a whole. And that is where harmony in society comes from.
Okay. I'm going to talk about animals. Ambrose, I think one thing I didn't talk about is that the context of the Stoic claims is a debate with the Epicureans. So the Epicureans also point to behaviors that infants do from birth, human infants and other animals. And the claim of the Epicureans is animals are acting for the sake of pleasure. This is the natural goal. And then in contrast to that, the Stoics are saying, no, they're acting for the sake of their health. Okay.
So are you saying that pleasure is wrong? Because the Christian and Hebrew scriptures obviously say that it is not wrong.
No, I'm saying that I think the Stoics have a better view, which says that pleasure is a byproduct of health. So it's typically, anyway, it can become disconnected from it. But typically, if an animal's in homeostasis, it feels good. And if it's injured or something is wrong, then it experiences pain. So their claim is that pain and pleasure are signs given by nature of whether we are in a healthy or an unhealthy state. Now, when you're transitioning from one stage of development to another, things get messier, like the baby that's trying to stand up but it keeps falling down. So it experiences pain in trying to do what's healthy because it's not yet in the next stage. So it's partly in the previous stage, in which it's not natural for it to stand up. With the case of dogs eating too much dog food, I wonder if it's not because they are eating food made by humans that maybe has too much pleasure added to it. So it's possible for animals to become habituated.
My black
pleasure.
Lab ate the most beef turkey in the sun, run over roadkill, nonstop, without chewing.
Maybe he was hungry.
That's my point.
Okay.
But
that we agree.
The lab is perpetually hungry, and if you're a lab owner and you don't regulate its food intake, it will explode.
Okay.
I mean, this is all head game, head game, head game, and I'm just wondering if it's more about union with the eternal being that some believe created this entire
right.
work.
Okay, well, none of these authors disagree with you about that. Not even the Stoics, because they say God made the world. God is the maker of the world. God is in the world, and he's continually making the world. So I'm not sure how much we disagree.
So you were talking about Augustine, talking about this natural law applying to people who are, about the use of reason, so I guess not to infants, but I was wondering just you're pausing there, is that...
I'm sorry, could you repeat it?
Correct there.
Okay.
He's talking about natural law applying to people who can use reasons,
yes.
Who are like also above a certain age.
Right.
But how do you reconcile that with, how does he himself reconcile that in his framework with like talking about himself as a baby and being such a sinner?
Right, so he says very clearly that we don't blame babies for these bad behaviors,
right.
But he is saying that that babies evidence the fact that oikeosis has gone wrong. I mean, there are problems with the way it functions, even from the beginning. So he talks about, from the time that I knew where I was, I began to assert myself in a way that was basically beyond the bounds of what was necessary for health. Like, I didn't want my brother to have milk. I wanted it all for myself. So he is claiming that it's this idea of sensus sui, right? The sense of yourself that the Stoics talked about, that once the animal gets an awareness of itself, even at the sensory level, in humans, because oikeosis is corrupted and messed up, it automatically starts to exceed the bounds of what's necessary. And so we get this self-assertion. But because it's not, the child doesn't understand anything, it's not blameworthy. So for something to be voluntary, you have to be able to give assent, according to the Stoics and Augustine. So before the age of reason, people actually don't give assent in the proper sense.
He calls himself a sinner, though.
Yeah, but it's like the inherited sinful condition. He's a sinner in that sense. Yeah. So tiny a child, so great a sinner. Yeah. But I mean, he does say clearly, we don't blame babies for this.
Right.
We laugh at it. Right?
Okay.
But we also discipline them to get them, to try to habituate them out of this distortion.
Let's give our thanks to Dr. Byers for a great finding.